You're listening to Admitting Diagnosis, the Journal Watch podcast for the week ending July 11th. I'm Joe Elia. On offer is a brief roundup of the week's essential medical news, plus an interview. This week, we talk with the president of the National Medical Association, Dr. Nelson Adams. If you'd like to leave us a comment, and we hope you will, call 617-440-4374. 617-440-4374. Story links are available at podcasts.jwatch.org. Okay, here are the week's four top medical stories in brief. AMA apologizes. Fluoroquinolones go into the penalty black box. Treating hypertension in the elderly doesn't promote dementia. And lastly, a HER2 gene test is approved. Here we go. The American Medical Association has apologized for its role in denying equality to African American physicians. More on this later. It's the subject of this week's interview. Next, the fluoroquinolones have earned themselves a black box warning regarding tendon rupture and tendinitis. Patients at risk are those over age 60, those on corticosteroids, and the recipients of transplants. Patients are urged to contact you if they have symptoms of tendon pain or swelling. And, of course, they are to avoid exercise with these symptoms. Next, some clinicians think that treating hypertension in the elderly, because it may lessen blood flow, will make the path to dementia that much easier. Lancet Neurology buries that notion with a bit of research on a large group of patients aged 80 and older. They all had hypertension, with systolic pressures between 160 and 200, and diastolic pressures below 110, but they had no evidence of dementia. The patients were randomized to treatment or no treatment for their hypertension. The study was stopped early when a survival and stroke avoidance benefit was seen with treatments. With regard to dementia, however, there was no evidence of a difference between the groups. Case closed. And finally in the roundup, the FDA has approved a test to help determine whether a woman with breast cancer would benefit from trastuzumab, trade name Herceptin. The test is called the Spotlight test, and it's a stain that causes HER2 genes in a tumor sample to stain in a way that can be detected with a standard microscope. Most people carry just two copies of the gene per cell, but some tumors, those susceptible to Herceptin, carry multiple copies. And here is the Journal Watch interview. Earlier this week, the AMA issued what can only be described as a startling apology. Not startling because it was undeserved, but startling because it seemed to mark sharply the end of an era of racism in American medicine. And the AMA acknowledged its role in the tragedy. Here is what the AMA said, quoting, "The American Medical Association today apologizes for its past history of racial inequality toward African-American physicians and shares its current efforts to increase the ranks of minority physicians and their participation in the AMA." It continues, "In 2005, the AMA convened and supported an independent panel of experts to study the history of the racial divide in organized medicine, and the culmination of this work prompted the apology." End quote. The nation's principal organization of African American physicians, the National Medical Association, said it had accepted the AMA's apology. The editor of its journal co-authored a study on racism in U.S. medicine that JAMA has just published online. We've asked the NMA's president, Dr. Nelson Adams, to spend some time with us to put the whole thing into perspective. Dr. Adams is an obstetrician-gynecologist based in Miami. Welcome, Dr. Adams, and thank you for agreeing to speak with us today.
Thank you so much for having me, and I'm absolutely thrilled to be here.
The NMA's statement in accepting the apology mentions the history of racial inequality that kept the AMA's doors closed to African-American physicians for more than a century. Does this feel like a unique moment in American medical history?
You know, indeed, I think it is. Certainly as it relates to institutions. Suffice it to say that these discriminatory practices have taken place both at the personal and individual and local level, but also at institutional levels. And And for the AMA to make such a courageous and bold pronouncement, I think, is extremely significant. Not so much because it allows us to pause for a minute and take a look back, but it allows us to assess where we are and see the kind of work and the amount of work and the significance of the work that is yet to be done.
And there seems to be a lot to do.
Absolutely.
Well, in that regard, how have patients suffered, and what do you think it will take to begin to undo that?
Well, that's an interesting question, and certainly on the surface, it sounds as if this is something that perhaps impacted only a relatively small group of individuals, i.e. black physicians. And indeed, that's where the pebble drops. But as a pebble falls in a pond of water, there's indeed a ripple effect. And the impact of denying black physicians access to the AMA certainly had a ripple effect. It was not just not being able to be a member of the AMA, but not being able to be a member of the local medical societies, the county medical societies, which oftentimes was linked to the ability to have privileges at the local hospitals, which is oftentimes related to the patients of those physicians being able to have access to the treatment modalities and the technology that was available at those hospitals, which impacted, you see this ripple going now, the kinds of services that were made unavailable to the patients who were served by physicians of color, and ultimately to a less than adequate outcome as it relates to health. Therein lies perhaps one of the enduring factors that we see today in what we call disparities in the health status of African Americans.
And so you think that that's directly a cause of those disparities that we see in so many reports, is that right?
Certainly a significant contributing factor.
Yeah. Well, that paper in JAMA covers events that ended 40 years ago. How would you describe the environment since then?
Well, you know, it's been said, and sometimes it's true, that the more things change, the more they stay the same. Now, I'm happy to report that that's not always the case. But as it relates to attitudes and behavior, sometimes it takes a while before they begin to change. That's why it was so important that if we go back 40 years, the civil rights legislation that took place and the efforts to desegregate hospitals and other public facilities was so important. And even though that took place, it has taken much longer for the behavior, if you will, of individuals to follow suit. I say all that simply to say that even in 2008, we still have individuals and institutions who still don't treat folk the same. And unfortunately, even when you control for factors like education and income and socioeconomic status, sometimes individuals of different races and ethnicities end up with different treatments, and the problem continues. So the IOM report that came out just a few years ago, I think, lifted that up very clearly, and there have been other studies that have made it clear that race, simply stated, does matter. Therein is the way that we segue into this whole notion of cultural competency. And that's sort of a broad statement, a broad phrase, one that certainly needs to be drilled down so that we get a better understanding in terms of what it is we're talking about and how we might make some movement, forward movement, to achieve the kind of care that all Americans deserve.
And when you're talking about cultural competency, are you talking about the education of physicians, about the various cultures that make up their patient base these days?
Absolutely. And in fact, you know, in its most simplistic definition, it simply is effective communication. You know, so often we say the right thing and recommend the right thing, but it's it's not either well received or even heard by the patient. And to that end, we have got to make sure that we become effective communicators. And one of the ways that we think that's important is to have the kind of training that allows you to be sensitive, respectful, and acknowledge, indeed, first of all, that folk don't always respond to the way that we think things. There's a good buddy of mine, actually, who's a Floridian, who's the past chair of AMA, who used to say frequently, say, it's not so much how you say it, but it's how you fix your mouth when you say it. Simply stated that, all of us respond differently, and we've got to try to tune in. And the first thing we've got to do is become good listeners. The second thing is to make sure that when a patient has had a interaction with us, that at the end of that session, that patient has gotten buy-in in terms of what it is that has been recommended, and that is a joint decision that we move in whatever direction it is that is going to represent the treatment for that individual.
I see. African Americans remain underrepresented in medical schools and in the profession at large. What can the NMA or can any organization do to address that? Are you aware of any initiatives in that regard?
Well, both AMA and NMA have scholarship programs, and I think that's helpful. But the average indebtedness of a medical student now at the end of 4 years of their medical education is in the ballpark of $130,000 to $140,000. And that's a lot of money. And that's on top of whatever indebtedness they had from undergraduate school. So it's a costly proposition, number one. Number two, preparation is key, and it doesn't begin just with med school or undergraduate school or even high school. That preparation has to begin in early education. Early childhood education, I think, is extremely important. There has to be a concerted effort by all of us who understand the importance of trying to have a workforce in healthcare that is representative of the kind of numbers that we see in the general population. Mm-hmm. Blacks represent approximately 13 to 14% of the population, yet only approximately 3% of the medical physicians, the physicians in the country. That number actually is about where it was, and some studies have actually said that it is less per capita than it was in 1910. So we've got some work to do. Margaret Heckler, back when she was Secretary of HHS, back in the mid-80s, had a study that was done that made it very clear, and one of the findings was that outcome was often related to a commonness between the provider and the patient. So if that indeed is true, and if indeed studies that project now that the country will be predominantly minority by 2050, that is, current minorities will be a majority of the country by 2050, and if indeed there's a health disparity, minorities are not as healthy, then we've got some real issues, because that's really saying that the majority of our country will be a less healthy, perhaps less educated, / less productive populace in just a few years. We can't allow that to happen. A rising tide raises all of the ships, and indeed we have got to do better. I will share this with you, that even though when we talk about health disparities and how we link that to the number of providers, health disparities is often compared with the white population.
Yes.
In the United States. And it needs to be clear to the listening audience that the health status of Americans in general is not that great. Nothing really to write home about. In fact, we're in the lowest quartile of health status of any industrialized country. If you looked at all of them, we're in that lowest quartile. So just saying the status of black health needs to be the equivalent to that of whites in America is not aiming very high. We need to understand that all of us need to do better. And we need to do that in a number of ways. One of my favorite sayings is as it relates to motivation, is that you can lead a horse to the water, but you can't make them drink. Well, our job really is to make them drink. And that's our institutions, AMA, NMA, National Hispanic Medical Association, our hospital systems, our government, our local, state, medical societies, all of us have got to do some real heavy lifting to change the paradigm from us being a less healthy country to us becoming a healthier country. And I think this look back that AMA has done gives us a great opportunity to benefit from the mistakes we've made in the past and determine a way collectively for us to come together and address them. There's much to be done, and this is healing that needs to take place.
Yes, there seems to be a lot of work for all of us to do. Well, one final question, Dr. Adams, if you will. What do you think in 30 to 40 years' time, do you think that we'll see the NMA and the AMA and the National Hispanic Medical Association have merged?
Well, you know, it's an interesting question, and you know, I'm pretty good at a lot of things, but so far I've not been too good at predicting the future. I don't have a crystal ball nor the gift of prophecy. But I will say this, that I certainly pray for a time when there won't be a need for all of these discussions about differences. Mm-hmm. You know, much like Martin Luther King Jr. would say, I really do hope that there will be a time when we're not judged by the color of our skin, but the content of our character. That day is not yet here. And until that day does come, there will be a need for the National Medical Association and other associations that focus on these disparities that exist, not just in healthcare, but across so many aspects of the life of the citizens of this great nation.
Well, Dr. Nelson Adams, thank you so much for spending the time with us today.
I do appreciate it. And remember, if you've got your health, you've got just about everything.
Thank you.
Finally this week, speaking of things uniquely American, the National Gallery of Art, in association with the publisher Steidl, has reissued Robert Frank's 1958 book, The Americans. It's a series of some 83 black and white photographs. Robert Frank came from Switzerland originally. Think of him as Alexis de Tocqueville with a Leica. If you've never seen the book and you like photography, find your way to this classic. If you'd like to talk about Robert Frank or something else, feel free. Call 617-440-4374. Just leave your name and number so I can get back to you and get your permission to put your comments on the podcast.
Story links are available at podcasts.jwatch.org.
For the Journal Watch podcast, I'm Joe Elia.